This is the Dutch International Service, Radio Netherlands. To commemorate the 50th anniversary of D-Day, Piet Myers presents a special edition of the Happy Station, marking the longest day in the history of Europe.
The sound, the orchestra, the man whose music is synonymous with World War II, Glenn Miller. 6 months after D-Day, Miller disappeared forever on a flight from England to France. Half a century later, in the town of Bayeux, Miller will be honored with a special concert of his music in the town square. Between now and September, more than 200 events in France, both grand and small, will commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Allied landings in Normandy. Over 50,000 World War II veterans will be there to honor the memory of their fallen colleagues. And monarchs, presidents, and prime ministers will be among the millions of visitors who will attend the commemoration ceremonies. Today, in Bayeux, they will unveil a statue to General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander of the Great Invasion. And 1,000 British paratroopers, together with Canadians, Poles, and French, will drop out of the sky. The main celebrations take place tomorrow, the 6th of June, a spectacle that will be seen by millions on TV. Now, how we relate to the spectacle and this day in history really depends on your age. I am a child of the war. I was 5 years ill when D-Day took place. I was living in a country that was untouched by the ravages of war, India, far from the killing fields of Normandy and Europe. My father was a captain in the war, but he fought in the Burma campaign. My mother, who came from a military family, drove an army truck in Madras. And my grandfather would often say that her driving was far more dangerous than the threat from Imperial Japan. I remember the truck, I remember the khaki uniforms my parents wore, and I remember the music that wafted from our tropical veranda, where my grandfather would listen to his shortwave radio and my mother would jitterbug to records played on a wind-up gramophone. I was never allowed to touch those records or play anywhere near that valuable equipment. But the music was always there, and it's remained with me ever since.
Buzzard took a monkey for a ride in the air. The monkey thought that everything was on the square. The buzzard tried to throw the monkey off of his back, but the monkey grabbed his neck and said, "Now listen, Jack. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. Ain't no use in diving. What's the use of diving? Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top." The buzzard told the monkey, "You are choking me. Release your hold and I will set you free." The monkey looked the buzzard right dead in the eye and said, "Your story's so touching, it sounds just like a lie. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and stay right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top." Choking me, release your hold, then I will set you free. The monkey looked the buzzard right dead in the eye and said, "Your story's so touching, it sounds just like a lie. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and stay right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and stay right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top.
The Andrews sisters, whose hairstyles my mother would religiously copy. Now, Mother had three brothers, Gerald, George, and Ernest. George, like my father, fought the war in Burma. Gerald was a teenager and was too young to join up. But Uncle Ernest was the warrior. Just before World War II broke out, he went to Britain and joined a regiment of the Signals Corps. In 1940, he was one of the thousands who was whisked off the beaches of Dunkirk. In his will, he left me his diary of that incredible evacuation. On June the 6th, 1944, he returned to France. But we, in distant India, knew nothing of it till much, much later. But I remember that day, and I have a little scar on the bridge of my nose to prove it. On D-Day, you see, while playing, I fell down and injured my nose. I was taken to hospital for a couple of stitches and arrived home to find my grandfather jubilant and excited. On his shortwave radio, he had heard the news of the invasion. But what he didn't know at that moment was that his eldest son, the warrior, was hitting the beach known as Gold with the British 8th Armored Division. Mother said that Grandpa was elated. All day he yelled, "The Germans are finished, we've got them on the run," totally forgetting the fact that his wife, my grandmother, was German. I had a black eye and a scar, which Mother would refer to as my D-Day scar. Uncle Gerald sulked and cursed the fact that he was too young to be part of history. In the 50s, he would finally age enough to join the army and spent years in Germany as part of the British forces occupying defeated Germany. He married a German girl, my Aunt Doris, and they lived happily ever after. My Uncle Ernest, the warrior, never kept a diary of his D-Day exploits, and when I questioned him about it, he remained strangely silent, as if the memory of that day was too painful to recall. All he would say is that war is a terrible, terrible thing, and that many of his comrades never returned from the shores of France. He spent the rest of his life attending reunions and visiting the old battlefields, and when he died 3 years ago, he only had one request regarding his funeral, and that was to hear this voice and this song as he marched away to eternity.
I'll be singing in all the old familiar places that my heart and mind embraces all day through. Chestnut trees, the wishing well. I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. But I'll be but I'll be seeing you.
Dame Vera Lynn, who sang her way into the history books and indelibly into the hearts of my father's generation. Happily, that voice can still be heard during these 50th anniversary celebrations. Of course, I belong to the generation who heard the tales firsthand of World War II, and we kept its memory alive. We had no choice. As a boy in school, the war loomed large in our history, in the tales related by our elders, in the books we read and the films we saw. What I know about D-Day is what I picked up in my extensive reading of history, and it's a jumbled array of statistics, anecdotes, and tales of courage and madness. D stands for the day of decision, the day of deliverance, the day of the invasion, take your choice. The statistics, daunting as they are overwhelming and epic. The greatest invasion in military history involving 185,000 men and 5,000 ships. By D-Day plus 6, over 350,000 soldiers would have crossed over. 18,000 paratroopers in gliders and aircraft. And the entire operation was codenamed
Operation Overlord.
The codenames for the Normandy beaches where the Allies would land were designated
Omaha, Utah, Gold, Juno, and Sword.
The giant artificial harbors that were brought across the channel were
Mulberry.
And the nautical operation was codenamed
Neptune.
These codenames were the best-kept secrets of World War II. And when I think of them, I think of an unassuming physics teacher in Britain named Leonard Dorr. Now, Mr. Dorr used to compile the crosswords puzzles for the Daily Telegraph newspaper. And during the 5 weeks prior to D-Day, the organizers of the Great Crusade were horrified to discover that their codenames started turning up in his crossword puzzles. Crossword question. Red Indian on the Missouri. Answer.
Omaha.
11 down. This bush is a center of nursery revolution. Answer.
Mulberry.
And worst of all, 11 across. Some bigwig like this has stolen some of it at times. Answer.
Overlord.
Naturally, the security boys pounced on poor Mr. Dorr, thinking that he knew the secret plans and was transmitting the codes to the enemy via his puzzles. But after intensive interrogation, they let him return home, somewhat bewildered. Conclusion, it was all an amazing coincidence. In June 1944, men and women went to war to the sounds of the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. They sang ditties like Maisie Doats and Daisy Doats and kept their spirits up by swinging into the Milky Way with Bing Crosby.
Would you like to swing on a star? Carry moonbeams home in a jar and be better off than you are? Or would you rather be a mule? A mule is an animal with long, funny ears. Kicks up at anything he hears.
His back is brawny, but his brain is weak. He's just plain stupid with a stubborn streak.
And by the way, if you hate to go to school, you may grow up to be a mule.
Would you like to swing on a star while sipping rum and Coca-Cola with the Andrews sisters? And as wives and lovers wave goodbye to their menfolk, fidelity was assured in one of the biggest hits of the year, sung by Jane Froman.
I walk alone because to tell you the truth, I belong. They'll ask me why, and I'll tell them I'd rather. There are dreams I must gather, dreams we fashion the night you held me tight.
I'll always be near you wherever you are. And if you were an American female teenager in 44, then the only thing you wanted was to be close to this skinny guy from New Jersey.
I couldn't sleep a wink last night because we had that silly fight. I thought my heart would break the whole night through. I knew that you'd be sorry, and I'm sorry too. I didn't have my favorite dream, the one in which I hold you tight. I had to call you up this morning to see if everything was still all right. Yes, I had to call you up this morning, 'cause I couldn't sleep a wink last night.
Frank Sinatra, 29 years old and suffering from insomnia. But if there was one song that will always be associated with D-Day and World War II by both German and Allied soldiers, it was this haunting melody first introduced by the German forces' sweetheart, Lala Anderson.
Eine Schritte kennt sie deinen schönen Gang. Alle Abend brennt sie, doch mich vergaß sie lang. Und sollte mir ein Leibs geschehen, wer wird bei der Laterne stehen? Mit dir, Lili, mit dir, Lili Marleen.
And with English lyrics, that song was also linked to a legendary beauty who tirelessly toured the Allied battlegrounds, entertaining the troops.
It's a song that is very close to my heart. I sang it during the war. I sang it for 3 long years. All through Africa, Sicily, Italy, through Alaska, Greenland, Iceland, through England, through France, through Belgium and Holland, through Germany, and to Czechoslovakia. The soldiers loved it. Lili Marleen. Outside the barracks, by the corner lights, I'll always stand and wait for you at night. We will create a world for two. I'll wait for you the whole night through. For you, Lili Marleen. For you, Lili Marleen.
On D-Day, Marlene Dietrich was singing for 4,000 GIs in Bari, Italy. She broke the news of the invasion to them, and 4,000 hats went into the air. In the occupied lands of Europe, and that included the Netherlands, people heard the news via the BBC. And for us, in Holland, via Radio Oranje, the voice of the Free Dutch broadcasting from London. It was a crime to possess a radio in Holland, but thousands did nevertheless. And when they secretly tuned into London on June the 6th, this is how they heard the news they had waited for since the beginning of the war.
Hier is allereerst een korte samenvatting van de laatste berichten die zijn binnengekomen. Minister President Churchill legde vanmiddag in het Lagerhuis een tweede verklaring af over de landingen op de Normandische kust in Frankrijk en beide onder andere. De operaties gaan voort op zeer bevredigende wijze.
Vlijtig tik de klok, tik-tak, tik-tak. Wat er ook geschiet, tik-tak, tik-tak. Bang de Friese klok in onze gang. En de klokkentoren klinkt ping-bang. Maar boem, luidt de Big Ben van boem. Waardig en fier, boem-boem. Klopt er ons hart, snel van blijheid.
And what Vera Lynn was to the British, Froman and Dietrich to the Americans, then Yeti Pyle was the darling of the Dutch as she sang her songs of defiance from the Radio Aranha studio. Now, radio was the lifeline for communication in 44, and it was through those historic recordings by broadcasters at the BBC and the American shortwave teams led by Ed Morrow that the world got to hear of the build-up to the invasion and the dramatic events that took place on June the 6th. On that day, in England, the celebrated English composer William Walton was feverishly putting the finishing touches to the music for a film, now judged as a masterpiece, directed and starring Laurence Olivier. Henry V perfectly captured the mood and emotions of the English-speaking peoples, and Shakespeare's tale of Agincourt, the battle on a distant field in Normandy, winning against all odds, well, that precisely fired everyone's imagination.
In peace, there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood, disguise fair nature with hard-favored rage. Then lend the eye a terrible aspect, let it pry through the portage of the head like the brass cannon. Let the brow overwhelm it as fearfully as doth a galled rock, or a hang and jutty his confounded base, swilled with the wild and wasteful ocean. Now set the teeth and stretch the nostril wide. Hold hard the breath and bend up every spirit to his full height. On, you noblest English, whose blood is fed from fathers of war proof. Fathers that, like so many Alexanders, have in these parts from morn till even fought and sheathed their swords for lack of argument. Dishonor not your mothers. Now attest that those whom you called fathers did beget you. Be copy now to men of grosser blood and teach them how to war. And you, good yeomen, whose limbs were made in England, show us here the mettle of your pasture. Let us swear that you are worth your breeding, which I doubt not, for there is none of you so mean and base that hath not noble luster in your eyes. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slip, straining upon the start. The game's afoot. Follow your spirit. And upon this charge, cry God for Harry, England and St. George!
England has become one vast ordnance dump and field park. In every wood and copse, in leafy dead-end lanes and side roads, often in private gardens, under quarries and embankments, there it all was. Trucks, ambulances, tanks, armored cars, carriers, jeeps, bulldozers, ducks, vehicles of all kinds. Vast, really vast numbers of them. Right in the midst of it all, just as I turned for home, I passed a field where 22 men in khaki shirts and battle-dress trousers and heavy hobnail boots were having a quiet knock-up game of cricket. They made me think of Francis Drake and Plymouth Hoe.
All contact with the shore has ended. No one may come aboard. No one may go ashore. In Navy jargon, the ship and all of us aboard here are sealed. We're sealed because we've been told the answers. The answers to the questions that the whole world has been asking for 2 years and more. Where and how and when. The troops swarmed up the rope ladders last night. Strong, healthy, formidable men. Many of them going into battle for the first time. As you walk along the decks, men are reading or sleeping or talking in small clusters.
All hands to meeting station.
This is the day and this is the hour. The sky is lightning. Lightning over the coast of Europe as we go in. The sun is blazing down brightly now. It's almost like an omen, the way it suddenly come out just as we were going in. The whole sky is bright. The sea is a glittering mass of silver, with all these craft of every kind moving across it, and the great battleships in the background blazing away at the shore.
From where I am, standing between the two pilots of this glider, I can see the navigation lights of the tug in front of us, and off the left and right, the navigation lights of other tugs and other gliders bound on the same mission. Circling above from time to time, I can see the lights of the fighter screen, which is protecting us. And looking back down the glider, there are seated, although I can't see them in the half light, officers and men, all laden up with equipment so heavily that they can barely walk. But they've got to carry with them the means by which they can fight the moment they land.
We're over the enemy coast now, and the run-in has started. 1 minute, 30 seconds, red light, green light, and out, out, get on, get out, get out. Out fast into the cool night. Out, out into the air over France. And we know that the dropping zone is obstructed. We're dropping, in fact, into fields covered with poles. But I hit my chute and lower my kit bag, which suspends on the end of a 40-foot rope from my harness. And then the ground comes up to hit me, and I find myself in the middle of a cornfield.
The BBC Home Service. Here is a special bulletin read by John Snay. D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress. The first official news came just after 9:30, when Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force, usually called SHAPE from its initials, issued communique number one. This said, under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces supported by strong air forces began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe, made in conjunction with our great Russian allies. I have this message for all of you. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching.
Walton's majestic music and Supreme Allied Commander Dwight D. Eisenhower. The gentle commander who wept when his forces went into battle because he knew so many would not return. But he was a commander who also knew how to seize the moment. On June the 5th, when told that a window of good weather would allow his great armada to set sail from the coast of Britain, he gave the order to go. But he knew it all depended on the element of surprise, and that it could easily have ended up in total disaster. In the event that his great crusade failed, he penned a note, which was found much later. It read,
"Our landings have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone."
And there speaks a noble warlord and future president of the United States. But the story of D-Day is full of noble warriors and their daring exploits, not least the reporters who hit the beaches armed only with a pen or a microphone, and the photographers who capture the moment with their cameras. Without doubt, the most vivid photographs of D-Day were taken by Robert Capa, who was to die in Vietnam 10 years after D-Day, covering the French War in Indochina. Capa went in with the first wave of American troops on Omaha Beach, the bloodiest beach of the war. Miraculously, he managed to shoot 106 pictures of the landing and then retreated to an outgoing boat. The world was waiting for the first pictures of the landing, and Capa had them on 3 rolls of film. They were rushed to a laboratory in London for processing, but the darkroom technician, dying to see the pictures himself, dried the film too fast. the excess heat melted the emulsion and only 10 frames of the 106 survived. On May the 23rd, 1994, one of those surviving pictures appeared on the cover of Newsweek. And then there was this descriptive report by another American who also arrived on Omaha Beach at the height of the battle.
I saw three of our tanks coming along the beach, barely moving. They were advancing so slowly. The Germans let them cross the open space where the valley opened onto the beach, and it was absolutely flat with a perfect field of fire. Then smoke broke out of the leading tank, and I saw two men dive out of the turret and land on their hands and knees on the stones of the beach. They were close enough so that I could see their faces. But no more men came out as the tanks started to blaze up and burn fiercely.
Omaha, as witnessed by a future winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, Ernest Hemingway. And 2 days before he wrote those words, in Paris, Edith Piaf recorded this song.
Jamais de repos, toujours courir, mettre au bureau et repartir. Et même le dimanche, il faut faire ses affaires, laver, repriser, repasser sa misère. Retour habillé au bout de la nuit, matin mouillé, pleurant d'ennui. Il n'y a pas de printemps le long de ma vie, je ne vois pas vos calendriers. J'ai beau faire des économies, printemps je peux jamais me le payer. Le mois de mes passés m'oublie, et le bonheur en fait autant. Est-ce que je suis pas assez jolie, mais dans ma vie y a pas de printemps. Mais et le 21 du mois de mars, quand le printemps chante à pleine voix sa naissance, avec un beau gars, il m'a fait faire connaissance. Il m'a dit viens, il m'a souri, et dans mon coin, tout a fleuri. Il y a du printemps le long de ma vie, et je me mode des calendriers, car maintenant c'est de la folie. J'en ai même au mois de janvier, j'ai plus besoin d'économie. Mon cœur et moi, on est contents. Peut-être que je suis pas jolie, jolie, mais dans ma vie, il y a plein de printemps.
The great Piaf stayed in France during the occupation and did extraordinary work for the French resistance, for which she was later decorated by her grateful country. Now, the role of the French resistance in the invasion was tremendous. On the night of the 5th and early hours of the 6th, they emerged en masse. It was their finest hour. France was in an open state of rebellion, and sabotage spread throughout the land. Bridges and ammunition dumps were blown up. Telephone lines cut. German road convoys attacked. The French railway network was absolutely crippled. On D-Day night, there were 950 interruptions on the railway. And while the French were crippling German transport on the ground, the British and Americans were doing the same from the air. And let's face it, the odds were decidedly stacked up against the Germans at the battle for air supremacy. The Allies could send out 10,000 planes on D-Day. The Luftwaffe had less than 1,000. In Moscow, Joseph Stalin was jubilant. At last, the second front that he had been asking for since 1942 had become operational. 2 weeks after D-Day, he unleashed his mighty Red Army and destroyed 130 German divisions in 10 days. It was a terrible slaughter that only ended when Russian soldiers finally got to the doors of Hitler's chancellery in Berlin almost a year later. But on D-Day, Hitler's terrible killing machine was claiming yet more victims. On that day, 1,795 Jews were picked up on the island of Corfu and sent directly to Auschwitz. Only 200 survived. And in Nazi Germany, the band played on. During the war, both Allied and Axis powers used radio for propaganda. And one of the curiosities of this propaganda war was Charlie and his orchestra, who would broadcast out of Berlin. It was a session orchestra led by Lutz Templin, and their routine was to take a standard song and change the English lyrics. First, you would have the original version, and then came the often hilarious switch. Take this example.
I'm putting all my eggs in one basket. I'm betting everything I've got on you. I'm giving all my love to one baby. Lord help me if my baby don't come through.
So far, so good. But then came the second chorus, and the crooner, one Karl Schwendler, went into the new set of lyrics, some of which were written by the notorious William Joyce, better known as Lord Haw Haw.
Here is Mr. Churchill's latest song to the Americans. I'm putting all my eggs in one basket. I'm betting everything I've got on you. I'm giving my British Empire to you, Yankee. Lord help me if my victory won't come through. I've spent a great big amount. Gone is my lovely bank account. Yankee, I've decided your dollars must be divided in two, or I'm through. So I'm putting all my eggs in one basket. I'm betting everything I've got on you.
Charlie and his orchestra, who made their last broadcast the day after D-Day. But of all the images of D-Day that I retain in my memory, the most poignant is that of a teenage Jewish girl sitting in an Amsterdam attic, scribbling her feelings into her diary, celebrated today as the diary of Anne Frank. On Tuesday, the 6th of June, this is what she wrote.
Dear Kitty, this is D-Day, came the announcement over the English news. And quite rightly, this is the day. The invasion has begun. Great commotion in the secret annex. Would the long-awaited liberation that has been talked of so much ever come true? Could we be granted victory this year, 1944? We don't know yet, but hope is revived within us. It gives us fresh courage and makes us strong again. Now, more than ever, we must clench our teeth and not cry out. France, Russia, Italy, and Germany too can all cry out and give vent to their misery, but we haven't the right to do that yet. Oh, Kitty, the best part of the invasion is that I have the feeling that friends are approaching. We have been oppressed by those terrible Germans for so long. They've had their knives so at our throats that the thought of friends and delivery fills us with confidence. Perhaps, Margot says, I may yet be able to go back to school in September or October. Yours, Anne.
50 years hence, those words are heartbreaking, for we know that by September, Anne and her family were in concentration camps, and that she had embarked on her last journey to an unmarked grave. And the liberation she longed for didn't come to the Netherlands for almost a year. It came too late for thousands in Europe, but it came. D-Day was the beginning of the end. The rest is history. What matters is that the invasion succeeded, and those who came to Normandy were not just brothers in arms, but blood brothers. Their courage and sacrifice will not be forgotten, certainly not by my generation. On a beachhead in Normandy, there stands a cross, and on it, these words. In the great mosaic of victory, these priceless jewels were set.
Thus far, with rough and all unable pen, our bending author hath pursued his story. In little room confining mighty men, mangling by starts the full course of their glory. Small time, but in that small, most greatly lived this star of England. Fortune made his sword, by which the world's best garden he achieved, and of it left his son imperial lord, which oft our stage hath shown, and for their sake, in your fair minds, let this acceptance take.
You have been listening to a special program commemorating the 50th anniversary of D-Day, June the 6th, 1944. The narrator, in extracts from Shakespeare's Henry V, was Christopher Plummer. Technical production, Mike van der Beemt. The program was written and produced by Pete Myers for the Dutch International Service, Radio Netherlands.